Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore. The Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance Conversation Series pairs artists and writers whose work overlaps in a unique way. Join us for a lively conversation between astronomer Lucianne Walkovitz and architect Fred Sharman as they discuss issues surrounding public space planning and planetary systems. Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at Bird in Hand Cafe in Charles Village, 11 East 33rd Street. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
It's Thursday, June 14th, 2018. I'm Dan Rogics of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 399, one short of 400. Today is the first day of early voting in Maryland's primary election. It continues through June 21st. The actual election day is June 26th, but Maryland Democrats and Republicans can start voting today at an early voting center in the county where you live or the city where you live. You can get a link to a list of polling places in the notes with today's podcast. On the show, another of the Democratic gubernatorial candidates, Krish Vignaraja, is back for her second visit. And in addition to talking about where she stands on various issues, we're going to get some insight on her campaign. She has been the subject of racist and sexist comments in social media and decided to take them public, her own version of mean tweets, to give people a sense of what it's like to be a woman and a person of color to run for public office. Now This News picked up Vignaraja's mean tweets video, posted it on Facebook about a week ago, and so far it's had 1.5 million views. We're going to hear some excerpts from it in a couple of minutes. Krish Vignaraja worked as a senior advisor in the State Department under Hillary Clinton and John Kerry before she took a job as a policy aide to First Lady Michelle Obama. Vignaraja announced she was running for governor last year, shortly after she gave birth to her daughter, Alana. Alana plays a prominent role in her mother's YouTube campaign ad, something that really annoyed the trolls.
There are no women in statewide or federal office in Maryland. None. This isn't just about representation. It's about policy. States with women in government have better schools, better health care, lower incarceration rates. I want all of that for Maryland. My parents came to this country with $200, and I grew up to be policy director for Michelle Obama. Some say no man can beat Larry Hogan. Well, I'm no man. I'm a mom, I'm a woman, and I want to be your next governor.
I get a lot of fan mail, man mail, hate mail. A lot of the comments refer to my sex, being a new mom, even the fact that I'm an immigrant. So we decided to have a little fun with the racism, sexism, xenophobia, and we put out a mean tweets video.
Hi, everyone. We've been receiving a lot of great responses from folks on social media. A lot of people who have been writing great comments, asking to get involved. But social media can be both a wonderful and a terrible place for a woman running for office. And more often than you might think, we field some comments that run from overtly racist and sexist to subtly racist and sexist. We try our best to ignore these comments, but sometimes we feel they deserve some sort of response.
And it reminded me of a very basic principle that Michelle Obama taught me early on, which was entertain him first and then educate him. And I say that because, you know, look, we've put out, you know, policy paper after policy paper on a range of issues. You know, how do we address the opioid epidemic? How do we address skyrocketing crime here in Baltimore? And of course, you know, people respond and engage with that. But we put out the mean tweets video. It's gotten 1.5 million views already. And I realized, you know, what am I doing? We've got to always entertain them first and then educate them.
From at Truth SE 2770957. Go back to India where you belong. Okay. First of all, I was born in Sri Lanka. I grew up in Baltimore, neither of which are India. And second of all, this is exactly why I support investing in civics education, social studies, maps. Use them. At VAWA is expiring. I should vote hashtag vagina. Why? Okay, at VAWA is expiring. Did you ask, should I vote hashtag penis every time you voted in the past?
Are you surprised at the level of that hostility that came across, what, in tweets and in emails?
Yeah, not really, in the sense that I remember early on when I was speaking with Senator Mikulski, she had said to me, you know, people will say to you what they said to me, which is, you don't look the part. And her advice was, you respond with, well, this is what the part looks like. And I realized that in some ways I am taking on conventional wisdom of, you know, who should be a politician, who should truly represent us. And at a time when out of 14 federal and statewide offices, there's not a single woman serving, again, today, I remain the only woman in the race. I, of course, realize that I'm going to be a lightning rod for a lot of reaction.
From Anonymous, maybe they can swear her in with the Kama Sutra. I now understand why you list your account as anonymous. That was stupid. So thank you for all of those fantastic tweets. I would say please keep them coming, but I really hope we don't have to do another edition of mean tweets. And for all those of you who have written, stop using your baby as a prop, well, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Had you had any experience with that kind of stuff before?
Yeah, I mean, look, I realized growing up as an immigrant, as, you know, woman of color, I was used to it. But of course, when you come into the public eye, there's, you know, expected increase in scrutiny. I think it's also that I have not shirked away from the fact that, you know, I am a woman, that I am a mom. And so, of course, some of those reactions are from folks who are enraged about the idea that a mom could be taped being a mom, meaning, you know, playing with my daughter, nursing my daughter.
Right.
So that
right.
sort of thing I, you know, have come to expect. But it is sad because it has given me a full appreciation for why my old boss, Michelle Obama, would never have gone into politics herself. You know, it's a contact sport. And fortunately, I don't bruise easily, nor does she. But, you know, for some folks, it's like, why is it worth their time?
I guess in growing up, you learned to keep your poise when people said mean things to you about what you look like and who you were.
Yeah, I mean, you realize that folks always have commentary. And I've never been fazed by it. You know, I think it always takes a little time for people to get comfortable in their own skin. Even for me today, I thought to myself as I was walking into the Sun Building, it sure feels nice to wear flats when you're, you know, a dominating 5'2". You know, obviously there is perhaps some pressure to wear high heels. But in the great state of Barbara Mikulski, and as I've heard on the campaign trail, the Shakespeare quote, though she be but little, she is fierce. I have realized that, you know, you got to be comfortable with who you are. And this race has certainly made me realize that, you know, love it or leave it. I believe that we do have something unique. I think we represent a new generation of leadership, and I think that resonates with people. But I think you've got to be authentic to you and who you are.
This is your last chance on the Roughly Speaking podcast to make a pitch to Democratic voters in Maryland. Our editorial in the Baltimore Sun points out that there are a lot of good candidates. I've noticed from doing interviews, one thing you learn is that they agree generally on most of the topics, most of the major issues. So what separates you from the others?
It is the fact that I am not a career politician, but have had executive experience at the highest levels. When I was at the State Department, I managed a $51.6 billion budget. When I was at the White House as Michelle Obama's policy director, I ran multi-billion dollar initiatives, including Let Girls Learn. But people don't just want to hear about qualifications. We obviously have a very strong field. And that's why I have tried to stress how personal this is for me. Being the only candidate in the field who is the product of Maryland public schools, in Baltimore County specifically, from kindergarten through 12th grade. Being the daughter of two Baltimore City public school teachers. Running with the only lifelong teacher, Sharon Blake, who taught in Baltimore City schools for 43 years, was the president of the Baltimore Teachers Union. Living in a basement apartment in Edmondson Heights. Living paycheck to paycheck, when my dad would, you know, hop on a bus on Route 40 and go to Edmondson High, where he taught. I know what it was to have public transportation. I know what it was to not really have options of affordable housing, to have to go to Enoch Pratt Library on a regular, you know, basis because that's how my parents saved on our electricity bills. And that's what I think people are looking, because people are so sick of the fact that politicians have consistently promised the moon and stars and not delivered on them. That's where I think that we have had a unique ability to lay out a progressive, bold agenda, but one that's doable.
Describe it for me. Give me three major points of your progressive agenda.
Our top priority is education. It's the reason I'm running. It's why I've been called the education candidate. That, to me, is about a cradle-to-career set of policies. Investing in universal pre-K for 3 and 4-year-olds, knowing that that divide between the haves and have-nots starts even before school starts. But also, you know, investing in schools as community centers, making sure that we provide hot and healthy breakfasts and lunches, investing in science, technology, engineering, arts, math, financial literacy even, civics education, knowing that November 8th wouldn't have happened if we actually didn't just teach for the test, but actually raised our kids as adults, intended to be productive citizens. But also knowing that, you know, my father would say this from his experiences at Edmondson, at Frederick Douglass, at Southern, you know, Western. Some of our kids are not going to come out of school and go to college. And so what I want to see is our kids be either career ready or college ready when they come out, which is destigmatizing the trades, making sure that just as at Woodlawn High School, and I give Kevin Kamenetz full credit for this, when you graduate from Woodlawn High School today, you have the option of graduating with your AA degree. That should be a program that's available at every school here in Maryland.
Associate's degree.
As an associate's
so
degree.
That gives you a step up going to anything, to a college or into a career. Is that what you mean? Into a trade.
Exactly. So if you choose to go straight from high school into a job, that obviously gives you a competitive edge in terms of you actually have a higher education degree.
So you'd like to do that in all the high schools in Maryland?
Exactly.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry. but the alternative is if you do want to continue on and go to a 4-year college, obviously having 2 years under your belt is a huge savings, which is important because right now in Maryland, on average, a student has $30,000 of student loans. Sometimes when people talk about, you know, women's issues, that's a women's issue because 2/3 of student debt that is held right now is held by women. But it's also why I want to make sure that we provide free community college as well as debt-free tuition at our HBCUs. My mom, when she started at Poly, she ultimately retired as a professor at Morgan State. My running mate, Sharon Blake, was a graduate of Morgan State along with 4 of her siblings. I believe that our HBCUs are our engine of upward social mobility in Maryland. And the truth is we're not investing in supporting them in the way that I think we could.
Give debt-free tuition for HBCUs? What about everybody else?
What we are providing is free community college across the board for everyone.
But yep. Debt-free tuition at a 4-year school?
At a 4-year school for our HBCUs.
But specifically for historically black colleges and universities.
Exactly. So any Maryland.
Because why? Why are you focusing there?
Yeah, sure. No, it's a great question. So we have rolled out a comprehensive HBCU policy in order to address the fact that for a number of years, we have underfunded our HBCUs. You look at some of the analyses that suggest that we have underfunded these schools by $500 million to $1 billion, I think suggests the magnitude of what we're talking about. Even things like the endowments of our HBCUs. Obviously, endowments are an incredibly important part of the operating ability of colleges. Our HBCUs, all 4 together, have an $80 million endowment. Many schools in Maryland have over $100 million for just one college. And so one way to actually support the schools is by incentivizing any student, regardless of, you know, race, to attend them.
What else you got?
Yeah. you know, a second piece of it, and, you know, maybe one way to sort of think about how I talk about the three big issues is if you think about the decision of Amazon to not list Baltimore as one of the finalists. I think that there were probably 3 reasons. One was the fact that our schools here in Baltimore, compared to Montgomery County, for example, are struggling. A second reason is the lack of investment in infrastructure. It is no surprise when you have a governor who cut the red line that, of course, Baltimore lost out on a massive employment opportunity when it came to Amazon. And so that's where, you know, a second key priority for me is investing in infrastructure, making sure that we do resurrect the red line. It's not going to be easy, I realize, but it's absolutely doable. We know that 250,000 jobs could be filled with a legitimate public transit option here.
Did you say 50,000 or 200?
250,000 is what a study had shown when there was an analysis of the red line. Of what the economic impact would
be. That would be from jobs created from the construction of it, and then also economic development along the red line.
So it would be jobs created by construction, jobs that exist that have not been filled due to the limitation when it comes to transportation here in the city, and then also jobs that would be created because of the economic opportunity.
Do you think it's realistic to revive the red line for the next governor to put effort into that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look.
Because a lot of it counts on federal money, right?
Right. I mean, and this is where Governor Hogan's decision to not undertake it early on when we had, President Obama's administration was to a huge detriment to Baltimore. What I plan to do as governor is make sure that all the pieces are in place with the expectation that in 2020, we will have a new presidential administration. But if not, we're going to find a workaround, because I do think that we could, through a revenue bond, generate the financing for the red line. It's just an economic opportunity that we can't miss. It's also investing in universal high-speed broadband in Baltimore. It's making sure that the Baltimore Link is a usable transit system, knowing that the meandering and multiple connections that anyone who actually tries to use it, it will take sometimes 2 hours to go less than 2 miles. That affects employment. But the third piece of it that I think is connected to why a company like Amazon didn't seriously contemplate Baltimore, and I think it speaks to what our top priorities need to be, is the skyrocketing crime. The fact that in a city of 615,000 people that we make headlines when we have a 12-day ceasefire, because in the last 3 years we have literally had a person die every day.
What's the governor do about that?
There's multiple pieces of it. First, it's acknowledging the failed strategies of mass incarceration, zero tolerance, mandatory minimums. Unfortunately, we have a governor who, after doing nothing on this issue for 3 years, all of a sudden comes into town, points his finger at judges, and says, really, this comes down to truth in sentencing. And time again, we've known that those are all failed strategies. But part of it is identifying and investing in the solutions that we know work. The school-to-prison pipeline. We know that programs like Operation Safe Kids have been incredibly effective in addressing this. Governor Hogan initially defunded it. And then what he did was held it hostage in terms of actually putting funding into it by making mandatory minimums the cost of refunding it. I think that's incredibly problematic to hold hostage funding that would have gone to at-risk kids. And that's how clearly it would be a distinction between me and the governor. Part of it is realizing that addiction is not a crime. It's a disease. It's where our moral and monetary interests align. I believe that if we invest in treatment, knowing that 1 in 10 individuals here in Baltimore who need treatment get it, there's a huge opportunity for us to address kind of skyrocketing crime. Part of it is also addressing community policing. We rolled out a policy that acknowledges the fact that to address crime, we have to have a law enforcement that looks like, lives with, and engages with the community. In Baltimore, our law enforcement, 40% of them are African American. Obviously, that is by contrast to the demographics here in the city. Only 20% are women. Only 20% live within city limits. We have known time and time again that if you reduce the distance between where an individual lives and where they work in terms of policing, you reduce incidents of, sort of these unarmed individuals being shot, because we know that that distance is what dehumanizes.
Has that been demonstrated elsewhere?
Yeah.
That if police live in a city, they're less inclined to, brutalize fellow citizens?
Right.
What have you learned from the campaign And I don't mean about campaigning. I mean, what have you learned from the people you've encountered, the Democrats, you know, potential voters that you've met and talked to? Did anything surprise you? Did people bring up an issue that you hadn't thought much about?
It has been so inspiring, the number of women along the campaign trail who will either, you know, bring their daughters and sons and say, you know, we wanted to be here to see you make history, knowing that obviously Maryland has never had a female governor. Just 2 days ago, I was in Hyattsville, and we were having a coffee with Krish. We've been doing these kind of across the state. We'll actually have one here in Baltimore.
They spell coffee with a K when they do that? Coffee with Krish? I'm kidding. Anyway, so what happened in Hyattsville?
Yeah, and there were, you know, a half dozen women, moms, who came with their babies. And not the kind of usual suspects on the campaign trail. The number of people who have said to me, I've never volunteered on a campaign before, but yours has inspired me to get involved myself. Or the number of people who have never politically donated before, but have come to me and said, I was the first contribution they've ever made. What is heartening is, look, I know we will never say Donald Trump, thank goodness he was elected. But I've never seen the electorate more energized and mobilized before. And
even when Obama ran for president?
Yeah.
What about that? That's tough competition.
It is tough competition, but this is where, you know, I remember November 9th walking back into the White House, and it felt like a funeral because, you know, a lot of our staff were crying. And Michelle Obama came by my office and she said, look, progress is not linear. And part of the problem had been that there was a complacency. That people thought, well, Barack Hussein Obama, we've elected him not just once, but twice. And so we were good. And I think people have been rattled from that complacency, obviously, with 2016.
What you could be seeing is an energy in the midterm that you hadn't seen before.
Exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, for us, we're heartened by the recent Virginia election. We just saw in seven races, six women win. And in that seventh race, there wasn't a woman who ran. In, you know, Idaho, Texas, we have seen this time and time again, which is when women run, they win. And so, you know, for me, you know, my old boss would say, you know, don't trust polling. And so we are excited about the fact that there has been an energy around women that I have never seen before, especially at a time when we don't have any women representing us in our federal or statewide offices. I have been inspired by the fact that women are just, women and men are thirsty for having the diversity of our state represented in our electeds. And so for us, we're excited. We believe that that momentum is what will allow us to prevail at the end of the day.
And you've referenced your running mate, Sharon Blake. So it's a double woman ticket.
Yep. So, you know, so we are the first all woman of color ticket in the nation's history. And
is
we're,
that right?
Yeah.
Running for governor, lieutenant governor?
Yeah.
In any state, anywhere?
In any state, at any point.
Wow. I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah.
I know it's the first all female ticket in Maryland in a long time, like a quarter of a century or so.
Yeah, a few decades,
and
exactly.
I have to look up who the last one was, but I saw a reference in one of our stories that it was, what, 25 years
ago?
Yeah,
something like that, exactly.
I have to check it out.
Yeah, I mean, and this is where, you know, it's funny, because there were some folks who said to me, you can't have an all-woman ticket, and you certainly can't have an all-woman of color ticket. And my response was, why not? We've had the exact opposite in election after election, and no one ever complained about that. As people have tuned in, I think it's been a message that has resonated, in particular as people have listened to the debates, the forums. We have won, you know, forum after forum, straw poll after straw poll. And I think those are the better measures of when people have some sense of me and Sharon. I think they get excited. And so for us in these, you know, remaining days, what we're planning to do is just make sure that we reach every single voter we can. And I think that's what will allow us to win at the end of the day.
Thank you, Krish.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
You've been listening to another in our series of conversations with candidates for governor in Maryland's upcoming Democratic primary. The winner of the primary will challenge the incumbent governor, Republican Larry Hogan. You can hear my earlier conversation with Krish Vignaraja in the Roughly Speaking archives, and you'll find conversations with each of the other five candidates there as well. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. For producer Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes naturalist Gabriel Talent to discuss his debut novel, My Absolute Darling, the story of a young girl's quest for redemption. Wednesday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.